Welcome to the Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Mortazavi, a journalist and political analyst in Washington. I'm also a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Today, I'll be speaking to Giorgio Caffiero, who is the CEO of Gulf State Analytics, a Washington, D.C.-based geopolitical risk consultancy. Giorgio is also an adjunct assistant professor at Georgetown University. Giorgio, thank you for coming back on the Iran Podcast.
Negar, it's an honor to be on your podcast.
It's an honor to have you. Well, before we begin, I just have a quick message for our listeners. I want to ask you to please consider supporting the Iran Podcast to help us continue our work and also be editorially independent. This podcast will not be possible without the contribution of listeners like yourself. So if you like this podcast, if you like our work, please go on anchor.fm/theIranPodcast and click on support this podcast. And then you can choose a monthly contribution amount and become one of our supporters. Again, that website is anchor.fm/theIranPodcast.
And I would just add that Iran Podcast is so valuable, especially during this period of time. And if you're in an ability, if you have the ability to support Iran Podcast, I highly encourage you to do so.
Thank you so much for that, Giorgio. So today we'll be talking about the Israel-Hamas war, the ongoing war in Gaza, and specifically how it relates to the GCC, the Arab monarchies in the Persian Gulf area. Let's first begin by talking about sort of the general picture, how this war has impacted the Gulf countries so far, it's as a whole block, and then also individually, since they each also have different policies towards the region.
Well, the Gulf Cooperation Council is a sub-regional institution made up of six different countries, and to be sure, each of these Arab monarchies has a different relationship with Israel and a different history of relations with various Palestinian groups. So there's not necessarily one single GCC policy toward Israel, Palestine. However, there are some common denominators between all of the GCC members, and there certainly is some common cause that all of them have in relation to the Israeli war on Gaza. The GCC states share concerns about this conflict in Gaza, this war on Gaza expanding into other parts of the Middle East, and the ultimate nightmare scenario is that it will come to the shores of the Persian Gulf. And this would such a scenario would obviously threaten the national security interests and the economic interests of the GCC states, which are focused right now on their internal developments and economic diversification away from oil and gas. In order for these countries to achieve their economic goals, they need to have stability at home and stability throughout the region. And as we know, the Israeli war on Gaza has expanded into the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden. It's also expanded into Lebanon and some other parts of the Middle East too. And basically, the GCC states all share the position that it is absolutely necessary for a ceasefire to come into effect immediately. Ever since this war on Gaza began in October 2023, the diplomats of the GCC countries have been working very hard, speaking to officials in Washington and many other capitals, trying to advance the peace efforts, trying to get a ceasefire in place. At the same time, the rulers of the Gulf monarchies have concerns about how the Palestinian cause can play out, not only inside their countries, but also in other Arab countries such as Egypt and Jordan.
Giorgio, if I may, let's first focus on the role of these different countries and some of the differences, because we talk about one sort of general policy in view towards the Palestinian-Israeli issue, but then there's also differences or different roles and different sort of positions, especially when we look at some of the main players, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and also the unique role, I would say, of Qatar. Can you talk about some of these differences, especially highlighting what the Saudi position is, the UAE, United Arab Emirates, and then we'll talk about the unique role of Qatar?
Well, I think among the GCC states, an important division is between those which have formalized diplomatic relations with Israel, that being the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, and then the other four GCC states which haven't, of course, that being Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, and the Sultanate of Oman. The GCC states that did not normalize with Israel, I think, have been able to navigate the fallout from Gaza with a little bit more ease. However, for the UAE and Bahrain, there's more of a delicate balancing act that they have to strike, which has certainly been, to some extent, a challenge. These two Arab Gulf states, again, UAE and Bahrain, have not shown any signs of an intention to abrogate the Abraham Accords or to withdraw from their normalization deals with Tel Aviv. They have their own interests in remaining in the Abraham Accords, which maybe we'll get to later. But at the same time, they don't want to be seen as allying with Israel at a time in which Israel is engaged in certain actions in Gaza that virtually all Arab citizens considered to be a form of genocide. So the UAE and Bahrain have been in a difficult position. And I think the longer this war on Gaza goes, these kinds of pressures have potential to intensify. We should note in the UAE, though, it's much easier to manage the situation than it is in Bahrain. In the UAE, there's a lot more wealth. The country is really a high-tech police state, and it's much easier for the country to keep a lid on any type of dissent. In Bahrain, the picture is different. You actually have a civil society. You have a political opposition that is quite significant, and the Palestinian issue has served to mobilize the opposition against the government at various points. So it's certainly a sensitive environment in Bahrain when it comes to this issue of normalization. But also in the other four GCC states, the governments are certainly under pressure from their own citizens to be taking a tough stance against Israel. The tough issue here, though, is that the governments certainly do not want to confront Israel in any serious way. They don't want to challenge Israel too much. And one of the main reasons why is because there would be a big price to pay in terms of their relationships with Washington, and all the GCC states count on the United States as a security guarantor. So they have to also strike these delicate balancing acts in which they're catering to public opinion on one side, but also being sort of pragmatic about some of their strategic interests.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this divide that you mentioned, sort of between the so-called Arab street, as in generally Arab societies, whether in these own countries or across the Arab world in other countries, and these GCC leaders that are seen in the Arab world as powerful, you know, wealthy countries with a lot of leverage, and sort of influence in the West. And the criticism that we hear coming from the overall Arab world or societies that they're not doing enough in using their leverage for the war, towards a ceasefire with the United States, with Israel, and how the criticism, as you mentioned, may have shifted some of the dynamics in this region among these countries, among these monarchies, and how do you see sort of this having an impact on the actual situation or the war on the ground?
It's a great question. I think it's important to note that in the Arab world, it is non-state actors that are actually being confrontational toward Israel. And by this, I'm referring to, you know, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as, of course, Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza. It's not the Arab states that are being confrontational toward Israel. The only state in the Middle East that's militarily confrontational toward Israel is non-Arab Iran. So the Arab regimes are certainly nervous about the way that these dynamics can play out, because their citizens would like to have the governments be more confrontational toward Israel. And we often see that there are Palestine solidarity protests in all over the Arab region. There have been Palestine solidarity protests in basically every major Arab city, for the most part. And the governments, like I said, are nervous, because oftentimes these protests begin with the citizens expressing solidarity with the Palestinians. But then the focus sort of turns to questions about why these governments are not doing more on behalf of the Palestinians. And then there are also questions about how they're cooperating with Israel, either in formal or informal manners, and why they're so close to the United States when Washington is giving ironclad to Israel. And then also these protests can expand to other issues that are not directly related to Palestine, such as corruption at home, authoritarianism, human rights abuses, mismanagement of the economy, so on and so forth. So basically, these governments get very nervous when they see their citizens protesting, and this helps us explain why many of these Arab governments view the Palestinian issue as a very dangerous one. And as long as the Israeli war on Gaza continues, they're going to be increasingly nervous about the way in which the Palestinian issue has potential to, from their perspective, have a destabilizing impact on different Arab countries. And I think this is what helps us understand why Arab governments, whether we're talking about Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, so on and so forth, why they're so adamant. And they talk to the Biden administration and they express their position that the United States needs to do what it can do to pressure Israel into agreeing to a ceasefire. For many of these regime officials, I don't mean to sound too cynical. I don't think it's necessarily about the well-being of the Palestinians in Gaza. It's more about their interests and sort of regime survival and maintaining a certain status quo order within their own countries and within the wider region.
Mm-hmm. So, Giorgio, let's also talk more about the Abraham Accords, sort of in relation to this very topic that we just discussed, and the divisions between some of the societies and the rulers. What is the current state of the Abraham Accords? We know the big prize was Israeli-Saudi potential normalization. The Biden administration put a lot of effort in trying to make that happen. And it seemed like it was in the process when October 7th happened, and now everything seems to be on ice or paused or delayed. What is your take on where the Abraham Accords stands till now? We know some countries already normalized. Do you think that's sustainable? Is that going to stay? And specifically, what do you think about the future of Saudi-Israeli normalization, potentially, if that's going to happen? Is it just delayed? What's your assessment?
You ask some very important questions here. I think it's important to first point out that after the UAE normalized with Israel in 2020, we saw other countries, Bahrain, Morocco, and partly so Sudan, join the Abraham Accords. And many analysts came to the conclusion that it was really just a matter of time until the other Arab countries joined the normalization camp. And up until October 7th, kind of a key question that was always being asked by Middle East observers was, which country next will join the Abraham Accords? Now, In the context of Israel's war on Gaza, there is really no reason to expect the Abraham Accords to expand in scope. At this point, it would just be too toxic for any Arab government to normalize with Israel. So the question is not which country will be next to join the Abraham Accords. The real question right now has to do with how countries that are already in the normalization camp are going to manage their ties with Israel. And there's also possibility, I'm not saying I think it's likely, but there's always the possibility of countries that are in the normalization camp deciding to withdraw their normalization deals with Tel Aviv. So I think that basically the Abraham Accords is frozen for now. I think maybe later on we could see other Arab countries normalizing with Israel, but that is not going to happen in the foreseeable future. You know, even if the dust were to settle in Gaza today, the effects of this brutal and horrific war on Gaza that has killed roughly 34,000, I think more than 34,000 Palestinians in the enclave is going to change the Middle East for many years, if not decades. And I just think that after everything that's happened over the past 6.5 months, it's going to be very toxic for any Arab government to join the Abraham Accords if they haven't already normalized with Israel. In terms of Saudi Arabia, there were expectations that Riyadh was going to join the Abraham Accords in the lead up to October 7th. Many in the media were kind of speaking about that almost as if it was inevitable. I was of the view that Saudi Arabia, even prior to October 7th, was not going to normalize with Israel. I thought that for a number of reasons. Basically, what much of it comes down to is the fact that it could create a tremendous amount of rage among the Saudi public at a time in which the leadership in Riyadh wants to have peace and stability in the kingdom. It also would have done a lot to undermine Saudi Arabia's credibility as a leader in the wider Arab Islamic world. And it would also be an opportunity for Iran to challenge Saudi Arabia's leadership role in the wider Islamic world. And the Saudi leadership was totally aware of all of these factors. And ever since the early 2000s, the Saudis have been very clear about their position. They would normalize with Israel, but there are concessions that Israel would need to make to the Palestinians. This is the Arab Peace Initiative that the Saudis set forth in 2002 at an Arab League summit in Beirut. The terms of this were very simple. Israel would have to return to the 1967 borders. There would have to be an independent, sovereign Palestinian state based on those borders with a capital in East Jerusalem. To this day, the Saudis maintain that position. Their position is still in line with the Arab Peace Initiative. And I was not expecting Saudi Arabia to abandon that position and join the Abraham Accords under current circumstances. Then after October 7th, I think that possibility was completely removed from the table. And it is really, really difficult for me to imagine Saudi Arabia normalizing with Israel within the context of this war on Gaza. There was a poll conducted by the pro-Israel think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, late last year. The think tank found that 96% of Saudi citizens believe that Arab governments should sever all political, diplomatic, and economic ties with Israel. The Saudi leadership can't ignore public opinion in the kingdom. It's completely wrong to conclude that just because Saudi Arabia has an authoritarian political system, the leadership can ignore public opinion. History has demonstrated that that's not the case at all. Even authoritarian leaders can't completely ignore the will of their people, especially when it comes to an issue such as the Palestinian issue that triggers so many emotions and sensitivities in an Arab country, especially a country like Saudi Arabia. Nonetheless, the Biden administration still seems to think that it's wise to continue investing diplomatic energy into trying to bring Saudi Arabia into the Abraham Accords. My personal opinion is that this is a complete waste of the Biden team's diplomatic energy. I think there is nothing that can come out of it. I think it would be wise for the administration to channel that energy into other initiatives that could actually bring real stability and peace to the Middle East. Nonetheless, I don't know what day this podcast will go live, but very soon Anthony Blinken will be in Saudi Arabia, and this is one of the issues that he's going to be speaking to the leadership in Riyadh about, and I am convinced that it will lead to absolutely nothing.
So, Georgia, let's talk about Iran. We know that Iran and Saudi Arabia made a deal, sort of reestablished diplomatic relations, a rapprochement brokered by China with the help of some neighboring countries recently. And the current war, the ongoing war, this expanding war has shifted some of the dynamics in the region. Talk about how this episode, basically this war, has influenced or changed the GCC-Iran relations in the past few months.
I think the GCC countries, especially Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain, have suspicions of Iran. And as the Gaza war continues and expands into other parts of the region, there are concerns among GCC officials about how Iran might act. Also concerns about the conduct of certain Iran-aligned militias in the region. But the GCC states right now are in a period of better relations with Iran. As your listeners know, in recent years, there have been renormalization of diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and then also a restoration of bilateral relations to the full-fledged level between Abu Dhabi and Tehran. And I think in general, the view in the Arab side, the Persian Gulf, is that it's healthy for these diplomatic relations with Iran to be restored, and that it's important to maintain a dialogue with Tehran at a time in which there are very serious and rather uncontrollable crises in the Middle East. The concern is that the war on Gaza could expand into the Strait of Hormuz or the Persian Gulf, and GCC states are certainly nervous about the Saudi-Iran detente falling off track in the event of that scenario. This helps us understand why GCC states certainly want to see a ceasefire put in place in Gaza as soon as possible. But at the same time, I think there's also some hope that the improved diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran, also between UAE and Iran, also the bridging roles between Arab countries in the West on one side and Iran on the other, that Qatar and Oman play, can certainly serve to counterbalance some of these other flashpoints in the region.
Finally, Georgia, let's talk about the recent Iran-Israel escalation. Israel attacked an Iranian diplomatic consulate in Syria, killed a number of Iranian military commanders, officials. Iran attacked Israel in retaliation from its soil, attacking Israeli soil, which was unprecedented. And then again, Israel retaliated by launching missiles into Iranian soil near the city of Isfahan. And the whole episode was pretty frightening for those in the region and could escalate potentially into something even bigger. It seems like it's been contained. Both sides sort of escalated in a limited way, but are now going back to the status quo. But talk about how that episode, that limited escalation, was viewed by the GCC, and has it sort of changed or shifted their perspective or position towards Israel or Iran, either of the two sides?
Well, officials in GCC countries found the hostilities between Iran and Israel during the month of April 2024 to be absolutely terrifying. As your listeners know, for many years there has been a quote-unquote shadow war between Iran and Israel, and that shadow war came to an end this month, and we're in sort of a new dangerous era of direct state-to-state military confrontations between Iran and Israel. There are these new rules of engagement in terms of the Iran-Israel hostilities, and the concern in the GCC states has to do with how these military confrontations between Iran and Israel have potential to affect the Arab world. And the GCC countries do not want to get caught up in the crosshairs of any potential Iranian-Israeli war. They are determined to stay out of this as much as possible. The GCC states do not want to align with Iran against Israel, nor with Israel against Iran. They are all in favor of de-escalating as much as possible and trying to maintain the geopolitical balance in the region. I think it's interesting to look at how the GCC states responded to Israel's attack on Iran's diplomatic compound in Syria on April 1st. I wrote an article for the Atlantic Council about how the GCC states responded to that episode. All of the GCC states, with the exception of Bahrain, condemned the raising of Iran's diplomatic facility in Damascus. But with the exception of Kuwait, none of them actually called out Israel by name. I think basically that was an attempt by the UAE and Saudi Arabia and others to be on record condemning that conduct, which is in flagrant violation of international law, bombing an embassy or a consulate. But they did not want to necessarily appear to be too aligned with Iran. So there was obviously some balance that they were able to strike. And then when the Iranian drone and missile attacks against Israeli territory took place on April 13th and 14th, the GCC states called for de-escalation, but they did not come out and explicitly condemn Iran for firing hundreds of missiles and drones at Israeli territory, again, highlighting their keenness to strike a delicate balance in response to that situation. As you mentioned, it seems that at least for now, the hostilities between Iran and Israel have cooled, and they're not continuing to move up the dangerous escalation ladder, and that's welcome news in the GCC states. But there's also an understanding that at a moment's notice, the hostilities could resume and return on that upward path along the escalation ladder. And that is always a concern for the leadership of all six Arab Gulf countries.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much, Giorgio, for your analysis.
It's a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
Let me also ask our audience once again to please consider supporting the Iran podcast. Help us continue our work. This podcast will not be possible without the contribution of listeners like yourself. So if you like our work, if you like the analysis of experts like Giorgio and others who've been on the podcast, please go on our website, anchor.fm/the Iran podcast, and click on support this podcast, and then choose a monthly contribution amount to become one of our supporters. Again, that website is anchor.fm/theIran podcast. And let me also give a shout out to one of our supporters, Thomas Sadowski, who's made a generous contribution. Thank you so much. And to our other supporters who are making our work possible. Giorgio, thank you again.
Thank you. And I would just add to that, that I speak on behalf of so many people who value the incredible work that Nagar does. And this podcast is extremely important. So again, if you're in a position to make a contribution and to support your own podcast, I highly encourage you to do so.
Thank you. Thanks so much. That was Giorgio Caffiero, CEO of Gulf State Analytics and an adjunct assistant professor at Georgetown University here in Washington. And thank you for listening to the Iran podcast. You can find us on all major podcast apps. So don't forget to subscribe to us and also leave a review and rating to help us be heard by more listeners. You can also follow us on Twitter or X at Iran podcast. I'm your host, Nagar Murtazavi, and until next time, goodbye.